Today we are thinking with a very familiar painting called American Gothic by Grant Wood. It was displayed for the first time in Chicago in 1930 at the Art Institute and won a $300 prize and gave Mr. Wood instant fame. It shows in the background a farmhouse that the artist encountered in Eldon, Iowa. But before I say too much, what do you see in the painting? And what do you think it's about?
Their mouths are just stoic.
They're stoic. What else do you see?
Not looking too happy.
Dave? Values. Interesting. Values. What kind of values?
Hard work, faith.
And Steve was, did you say something?
I hope he's a fast painter.
Okay?
He's got a weapon in his hand.
You hope he's a fast painter because that pitchfork, right? They need hairstylists. What's it about?
They need hair.
They're happily married. It's like that, talking about those kisses last Sunday, right? We don't know. Yes, Peter.
The timing of the picture gives me the impression that they are concerned because it's just the beginning of the Depression.
Yes, it's just the beginning of the Depression, so they're concerned. So they have a very structured lifestyle, but they're very good at that structure because they look successful. Their house is very nice. Yes.
They are steadfast.
Steadfast. Good word.
They look almost impatient to get back to work.
They're impatient to get back to work. Yeah, what are we wasting all this time for, right? So Grant Wood, the painter, was an Iowa native. He had traveled and studied in Europe, but he returned and settled in Iowa for a time. And this was a real home. But these were not the real owners of the home. These were people the artist found from his personal life. The model for the woman was his sister, and the model for the man was his dentist. But then he stretched their faces out much longer than they actually were in life. And in the painting, he shared that he intended them to be a father and a daughter. But he was recalling that custom of traveling painters in the late 1800s and early 1900s who would go to a home and offer to paint a portrait of the family. And because it took so long, right? No one can hold a smile for that long. And so the families often chose not to smile for their portrait. Here are some themes that I think come through this painting. The people and the house are serious and they are practical. But if you look closely, there's something lovely everywhere. So the house has that very lovely window, even though it's a serious and practical house. The woman who is serious and practical has a curl. Can you see her curl? And the man has a decorative button. So there's something lovely in the midst of their seriousness. You might be able to see it better on the front of your program. And then there are some contradictions in the painting. That loveliness is contradictory, but also, what about this man? He's wearing overalls with a blazer, right? So a contradiction. And then I think this is connected to what Peter said. There's kind of a defiance, right? They're in a time of turmoil, but they are steadfast, as Edie said, and they maybe have some fear even though, because he's got that grip on the pitchfork, and they seem a little worried. And then my question about the pitchfork is the pitchfork holding him steady, right? Is that the thing that's holding him up? Or is he using it like a weapon, you know? There's a question there. They could be fierce survivors, or they could be feeling a lot of fear. Something that's often brought up in conversation about this painting is its relationship with the past. So people disagree about the artist's intentions. Was he idealizing the past, or was he criticizing it? In this time of change they were experiencing across America, that couple is clearly rooted firmly in the past. And if you think about the pitchfork as a symbol of agrarian life, then they are gripping tightly to the past. They are hanging on to it for dear life. My sermon today is titled, This Past and Present Dance. And this dance is something that's expressed in the painting. In life, there's a tension always between past and present. How do we cling to the past? And what do we let go of so that we can move forward? Should we be cautious about the consequences of change and moving into the future? Or should we just charge ahead with abandon? What about the past do we need to protect and cherish? And what about the past holds us back? It's always a dance. We face this dance in church often. Should we try new things? And the voices say, no. Right? What things do we keep? Because we've always done them. And then what things do we keep? Because they are worth keeping. The past is the story that makes the present possible. Yet we also know that flexibility and adaptability are essential to life and growth. The church has always been in conversation with the world around it, even from its earliest beginnings, as we heard today in Paul's letter. In Philippi, a faction of Christianity insisted that following the law of circumcision was a necessary part of the new Christian faith. And Paul rejected that position fiercely. For Jewish believers in Jewish cities, the continuation of that covenant made sense. It was natural and seamless. But when Paul went and preached to Gentile areas in Greece and Rome, a requirement like this became an obstacle to new believers. In this past and present dance, it was for Paul the religious practice that had to give way. Even the theology, the worldview about God had to change. Old requirements and paradigms needed to go by the wayside in order to carry that message forward. We see in this fluidity of the early church that it's not necessary to fear change, even though we do. It's not even necessary to fear change in the fundamentals of our faith. There's also a very personal element in this letter about Paul's life. He let go of all the symbols and status from his past that had given him security in exchange for the message of Christ and the cross. He said all of his gains were now garbage. His value system underwent a complete reversal. What had been everything was now nothing. Whatever he had hung his hat on and taken pride in was now empty. But it was in exchange for something worth so much more, that surpassing value of knowing Christ as Lord. This reversed relationship with the past happened because his understanding of God changed. And when it did, it changed what he thought about his whole life up to that point. Paul sums it up like this: this one thing I do, one thing, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead. We see a fundamental move here that we need to learn if we are going to live the spiritual life well. The ability to shed regret and abandon guilt. Guilt and shame play too much a part in religion because a life of well-being demands forward-looking introspection. Rather than being haunted by the demons of what could have been and what you did. Do you know those two? They're sort of like the ghosts in Dickens' A Christmas Carol. What could have been and what you did will hang around and they will pester you. They will talk way too much. They will keep you from pressing toward the prize. And what you said is a pretty bad friend as well. You know those TV comedies where there's always an annoying neighbor? That's what these three are like. But rather than engaging in that regret and self-doubt, it's far better to accept God's grace for our mistakes, take that wisdom you've gained, take your convictions to do it differently, but let go of those friends. Put those three annoying neighbors out the back door and lock it. In our passage from the book of Jeremiah, the prophet calls out Jerusalem as being a city of oppression, violence, and greed, and accuses the religious leaders of giving the people cheap platitudes instead of addressing their actual problems. In the face of this, Jeremiah brings them a warning from the Lord and this word of guidance. Stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths. Where the good way lies and walk in it and find rest for your souls. This is the other dance with the past, the other side of the coin. Sometimes the past holds the answer in what is unchanging. So how can we keep up in this world when what was urgent news or the hottest item 12 minutes ago, last month, is so quickly forgotten? To be up to date in this society is a mad sprint. Our lives move fast, and there are so many options. Like the many endings of a choose-your-own-adventure novel, except replicated in a funhouse mirror, so much that it's disorienting as we try to live faithful lives. But some things, even in this mad sprint world, some things last. Some truths hold in the ancient world and still today, and those are the ancient paths that can guide us and grant us a compass in this ever-changing world. Stillness, loyalty, mercy, love, generosity, peace, friendship, grace, patience, courage, forgiveness, sacrifice, simplicity, hope. In this world where novelty and change can be oppressive because they happen so fast and they are everywhere and everything seems mutable, these ancient paths are what we need to discover. So we have this past and present dance, the art of discernment about change and stasis, what to keep and what to let go. Paul's letting go of what lies behind and counting it as rubbish and even changing his worldview about God. And then Jeremiah's ancient paths. Good ways that last and guide our steps. But I would venture this. The eternal things that Jeremiah calls us to cling to are the very same truths that led Paul to let go of the past. Paul wasn't running after the next new thing. Paul was allowing the deepest truths, in this case, grace, to find their full expression, to win out over other claims that hindered them even if it meant change, change of the deepest things in his community and his life. For example, if we walk on the ancient path of generosity, it will call us to let go of much we have gripped tightly. If we cling to mercy and walk on that ancient path, we will many times be called to change our practices and our rules as we encounter new people and new circumstances. If we embrace the ancient path of courage, we may soon be charting a new course. These ancient paths, these eternal good ways, are the constants we turn to for wisdom in uncertain times, and their compass may lead us to right and needed and grace-filled change, and to let go of the trappings and maybe the traps of the past. Christianity has always done this dance, this past and present dance. The story of Christianity is one of change from the very beginning. It was a new religion. We forget that. It was a new religion, and it was formed by changing the rules and the practices of their history, and even in disagreeing with their scripture. It was led by the Spirit, bringing new and surprising revelations. And the story of Christianity is one of ancient paths at the same time. Paths that from the very beginning were rooted in the faith of Abraham, the covenant with God, the Torah, the freedom of the Exodus, the challenge of the prophets. In the same way, we, as followers of Jesus in a postmodern or post-postmodern world, a world no one from the first century would ever recognize, with instant information and global travel and the scientific revolution, we followers of Jesus are people who navigate what to let go of and what to hold on to. How can we embrace learning and discovery while remembering the value of what takes time, what takes nurture, what takes creation? How do we embrace ethical progress and transform our faith from unjust systems like patriarchy and racism, while also remembering that faster and easier are not necessarily good and not always better for the world? And so the gospel for us today is this: forget what is behind and strain toward what lies ahead, and stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths where the good way lies and walk in it. Let go of what needs to be let go of, but keep what is good both. Let us dance with the Spirit, the past and present dance. Amen.